Today, structure is a dirty word. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And today's show is a follow-up with John Dalson. John spoke with me last week about the Royal Commission recommendations and findings and raised a whole series of very interesting questions. Now, we've had a bunch of questions from our audience, and I want to take some of these back to John and have a more detailed conversation, also in the light of the fact that now there is a Senate review into the structure of banking and structural separation. Thank you very much for spending the time. So I think a really good place to start would be with underlying structure is the fact we've got very small number of very large players with undue market influence.
That's right. Well, we only have four banks. They're a huge percentage of the ASX. I think it's 26% when I last looked, but that may not be absolutely correct. And they're a huge percentage of GDP. That's almost a higher than anywhere else in the world. That of itself is a worry.
Right, because presumably, given that, well, should we say an oligopoly, to be polite, that they are effectively in a position where they can expose their market power. And in fact, the Productivity Commission quite recently called that out in respect of, for example, the mortgage sector, didn't they?
Yes. Well, it is an oligopoly, and I don't think we should mince words. And I think a lot of if you go through all the various commission reports, they don't repeat the word very often. I think that's well and truly accepted by everyone.
Okay. So one of the questions that came up then was, you know, are we seriously going to be able to make our banking system better simply by effectively taking what we've got and making some structural tweaks to them, or do we need something more radical? I think your view to me last time was there's plenty of opportunity if we apply structural separation right to release value and to make basically the banking system work better.
Yes, that's right. I think that the one area that all the inquiries have never adequately looked at is the role of structure. Although, interestingly, Rod Simpson, the ACCC's, made some comments about that the other day, particularly in relation to banking, where he is concerned about the structure. And he's in effect saying that the structure itself is causing a lot of problems. He says that competition theory or competition law is behind the game, and competition law needs to be expanded to cover the kind of situation that we've got. And he's faced this up in various cases on merger inquiries where he hasn't done too well. And he wants the court to look more at if I can put it this way, the role and the of the structure per se, also the purpose or behaviour of the banks. Whereas the law talks about the effect on competition, the emphasis being on effect, not purpose or structure. And what he's saying is, if I can read him correctly, is that US law is further advanced than Australia and we need to make change. Now, I suspect what he might do is that he might take on a case to try and test the boundaries a little bit in this area.
Well, it certainly is an area that needs to be explored. And of course, the Senate now has a 2-month inquiry into the question of structural separation of the banks. So that was effectively off the back of Pauline Hanson's motion that was passed in the Senate last week. And so they're going to be looking at this as well. And it seems to me that the old traditional argument always was that the banks needed to be large to get scale. And the bigger, the greater the scale benefits they actually had. But it seems to me that that's probably not a very powerful argument these days.
No, I don't think it is. And I think you could test it this way and say, if we had a fifth and sixth bank in this country of the same sort of size of the four, competition would be a lot better. And there would be sufficient scale in all those organisations to be successful. And it's interesting that there's been some attempts by the banks, the so-called four pillars policy, where they want to reduce from four to three or four to two. And, of course, Peter Costello, when he was treasurer, very wisely said no way. Because I think what people miss in that is that the it's the reduction in consumer choice. There's simply, in our market, there's simply not enough choice for the customers as compared with other markets around the world. And when the four control 80% of the business, that means that there's plenty of scope for a fifth or sixth player, and definitely not reducing it to four to two. That would be a disaster. But I don't think anyone would sensibly put that argument now. But certainly 10 years ago, there were people that were saying, oh, look, we'd be better off with four to three or four to two because it would enable us to compete internationally. Well, of course, the international is a non-issue now because our banks aren't going offshore except for Macquarie, and none of the foreign banks are coming to Australia. So we can park that argument. And I think we can park the scale argument.
And I think we can also make the point that the shareholder returns that the four big Australian banks have made relative to their international peers are significantly higher. And that probably doesn't necessarily mean that they're great, much more efficient, much better run. It's simply that they don't have the same competitive pressures on them and are able to to charge like a wounding bull.
And there are characteristics of oligopolies that help that process of improving the return on capital. I mean, competition costs money. And when you don't have to compete, you save a lot of money. You don't have to flex your prices. There's all sorts of things that you don't have to do. And when you add up all those factors, it's very significant. So you can understand why they've been so profitable. The message from some people has been, oh, because they're extremely well run. Well, my view is that it is from their oligopoly position that has enabled them to make those profits. Now, the interesting thing about an oligopoly is that all business people want to finish up with an oligopoly or own the market. I mean, we all want to acquire people so that we've got a bigger market share, we make more efficient. So, in effect, an oligopoly is a natural extension of what businessmen want to do. And that's why the legislator has to intervene. But the interesting thing about banks is, of all the sectors, it is in the public's interest for the banks to cooperate on a lot of things. In other words, to engage in cartel behaviour. For instance, the payment system. And there are other things where it's very important for the community to have these common platforms. So the banks are in this odd position, unlike other sectors, where they engage in certain kind of cartel behaviour in the interest of the market, in the interest of the public. And in other areas, they can't. And it's very difficult to divide your soul. You're neither one or the other. And because the banks had to cooperate together, there's the danger that this flows on. And you know, where is the boundary between cartel behaviour that's in our interest and where it is not? And I think that's something that's agonising Rod Sims at the moment. And I think he'd believe that a lot of cartel behaviour is not in the public interest. And I think he wants to test where those boundaries are.
Yeah, well, I think it certainly should be explored. I guess there's another point too, John, isn't there, that if you are actually in a fortunate position to be one of those very large players of a small number of players, you actually end up in a position which is called too big to fail. In other words, you are such an important part of the overall economy that you can pretty much hold the country to ransom or the government to ransom in a crisis.
Well, exactly. And what's happened in the past is that some of the second-tier banks, what has happened is that the government, or I should say Treasury, probably both, have spoken to the bank and said, look, you better take over X because they're about to fail. won the public arena was the Commonwealth takeover of Bank West. The Commonwealth Bank was virtually asked to take that over, and as a result, inherited a hell of a lot of problems. Now, as I said, we haven't faced up to one of the big four being tested in this area. But the fact is that the four banks are so intertwined and such an important part of our economy, it is just not imaginable that if one of the four got into difficulty, that the pressure would be on the others to take it over in whole or part to save economy failing. Because I don't think, I don't know if they've been currently doing any stretch testing to see what would be the ramifications of one failing. I would hate to think what those numbers are. So the business reality and the political reality is that they'd have to be taken over. Now, a corollary of that is the bank's behaviour in relation to the Hayne Commission. To me, it is pretty clear that the banks tightened up their lending arrangements to frighten Hayne, because that 30-year recession started to appear in the press. And I would be amazed if Hayne didn't get a lot of direct and indirect pressure. Look, be careful, you might cause a recession. Now, it's extraordinary that we have a banking system where the banks can have that much power. In other words, their refusal to do something affects the economy and affects the decision-making process of a commission or a government. And that's the other side of the coin, that they're too big to fail.
Yeah, indeed. The thought I had there was that, you know, last time you said, well, the thing to do is to understand that you've got these very large organisations with multiple lines of business, and you can actually drive significantly enhanced efficiency by chopping them into smaller, more manageable pieces and create greater competition. But it also then diffuses the question of too big to fail, doesn't it?
It does. But the other thing about our banks is that they're very complex, and they're in quite a diverse range of financial products and services. And they're very, very difficult to manage. And we've seen the evidence of that with the Royal Commission. So this question of separation or breaking up, there's a lot of sound business reasons why you might want to do that. Not just the issue of competition, or not just the issues that arise from Glass-Steagall in the US. I think there's some profound business reasons why you would want to do it. And I happen to think that if there was some demerging, I happen to think that the market would reward the banks. And I've seen a report from one well-known investment house, and I dare say the others have it, where they've analysed all the demergers that have taken place over the last 10 years. And my recollection from that report was that a high proportion of them add value. So I think you could mount a powerful argument that demerging the banks would create value. Now, one of the important things for this commission to look at is to test that hypothesis. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of bank analysts around that could play around with the numbers. Now, I do acknowledge with banks it's difficult because there are a lot of shared services that underpin the various departments in a bank, just as there is in the whole of the banking sector. But those issues are not impossible to solve. And I think I said in my last session that there wasn't but one bank, not ANZ, because I'm not prepared, I can't talk about that, where they did look at it, and where they had a holding company, and where they had a pure holding company with no activity. And they had three or four subsidiaries in the various divisions. And my understanding is that the reason they couldn't go bad was because of the problems of capital gains tax and stamp duty. Now, you know, capital gains tax, usually when you have an exchange, you are not taxed. But I think the problem is when you get into the intricacies of a transaction like this, you need to know that there's no capital gains tax. And at the same time, you might want to introduce other shareholders, which means you're denied the exemption. So if a government is going to say, Mr. Banks, you've got to demerge, and I think it's only appropriate, therefore, that the bank, sorry, that the government should get rid of those inhibitors and say, we will give you capital gains tax exemptions for doing this. And secondly, we'll try to persuade states that you should similarly should have an exemption from stamp duty. Now, other people might say, why can't we have those benefits? Because my view is there's a lot of transactions that are held up in this country because of those two inhibitors. And it's not good for the formation of capital. Now, you know, they have put in place in stamp duty and in capital gains tax legislation, they have put it in exemptions. But unfortunately, those exemptions aren't wide enough. And I don't think that we maybe should get some professional view on this. My impression is that there's not enough width in those and not enough discretion there to cope with the kind of an emerging where you might want to be more innovative, not just in exchanging value, but introducing other shareholders, etc. So if those inhibitors were removed, I think a good analyst could show that process of demerging creates value. I believe the share market would welcome it, because implicit in that statement is that on demerging you'll be more efficient. And I think that's highly likely, because a bank is like a department store. It's why the department stores are failing. There's too many areas, and there's too many specialists coming in to compete with them. You've got, for banks, you've got on the one hand, you've got the big technology companies that have got massive resources that are coming into the marketplace. And then you've got all the fintechs nibbling around the edges. So you've got this pressure from two sources. And you can look at the fintechs and you can say, oh, they're all very small. But look, when you look at every segment of a bank and you list all the little fintechs that are nibbling around the edges, you aggregate that. And then you look at the big multinational tech players, and there's maybe eight of them. Boy, have they got the power. So there's this pincer movement. So I think you've got to rethink the bank structure and say, what will be more efficient to enable not only better competition for the consumer, but better for the shareholder and better for the market. Now, the other thing I think is fascinating about this is that Macquarie Bank has essentially limited its activities, but it's gone worldwide. Now, the other day, the chief executive got up and how excited she was about all the opportunities she got for growth. And so she's in a different world. And my prediction is that with the way things are going, Macquarie Bank will finish up bigger than any of our trading banks, because the trading banks are good at a few things, but not brilliant at any. Whereas Macquarie Bank, it's a very streamlined, efficient, effective business model. So we've got to open our eyes and open our minds and just look at this. Now, I'm not saying that what I'm putting forward has got the answer, but what I do say, it deserves analysis. It deserves consideration. It deserves the best minds in the country talking about it and challenging some of the hypotheses I put on the table. I might be completely wrong.
But the powerful argument that you have there, John, is so one, this gets you better customer outcomes. Two, it makes the organisations more efficient and can be managed more effectively. It That's solves right. the too big to fail issue, because essentially they're yes. sliced and diced, and it can release and create value for shareholders as well.
Yes. So there's two other very important factors.
Yep. Yep.
Very important factors. And the first one is the government guarantee, which there's a lot of controversy about, which is part of a, you know, can't fail proposition, which the government had to put in place to stop a failure.
Hmm.
Now, I think if you separated commercial and retail banking, it would be appropriate that government guarantee should only apply to the retail bank, that the commercial bank will be on its own. It would probably finish up borrowing most of its money out of the wholesale market, probably paying slightly higher interest rates, and would probably have to charge slightly higher rates. But the fact is, the commercial market in Australia is so wide and so underserved that the notion of creating, in addition to Macquarie Bank, four specialised banks in the commercial area will mean all those nooks and crannies that are not being served, all those complaints from people saying, you know, that they can't get a loan, that would hopefully would disappear, because you've got four of them in that activity. They've got to find growth somewhere, and that's where they find it. Now, the other thing that's not talked about a lot is derivatives. Now, I think derivatives are difficult. I've said before that when I was involved with derivatives, I had a huge trouble in understanding it. They are very complex. And before some of my meetings, I would talk to a couple of staff members. They had to spend some time explaining to me the accounting for derivatives. And what had happened is that after their explanation, I would understand it, but only for half an hour. Because when I went, I tried to go back to it an hour or a day later, and I didn't, because it is so incredibly complex. Now, there's been a famous professor in the UK that's written this book on financialization, where he's looked at the derivatives market, and he is exceedingly worried that the exposure on derivatives is incredible, many times more than the exposure of the banking system, and that if we had to meet, the banks had to meet all the derivatives, it would be chaotic. Now, one thing that if you did have a separation, I would want to do would be to limit to the retail bank to the classic derivatives, those that just involve matching your assets and your liabilities, and helping customers in terms of length of exposure and sort of stuff. Any kind of financialization or any kind of trading in derivatives other than direct for a customer, I would put into the commercial bank. Because I don't think you can justify having a bank guarantee on a retail bank which is gambling on derivatives. Now, that word gambling is very controversial, and I will be hit over the head for saying it. But this book on financialization pretty much convinced me about the quantum of gambling or casino-type activities. And I had difficulty understanding them when I was involved with ANZ, because the problem was it wasn't a simple derivative like matching your profile of assets or your profile of liabilities or a customer loan. It was complication on complication on complication. And you could look at one transaction as there was a whole chain of deals. And it makes the accounting for them extraordinarily difficult. And the big accounting firms must have to spend a lot of time putting themselves in a position where they can vouch for the derivatives of a bank. And I certainly wouldn't like holding the insurance policy on that. And the other thing is, we haven't tested some of this derivatives market because of the good times. But look, someday it might get tested. So whilst I'm not solving that problem about gambling, I think by segregating it, you make the depositors in the retail bank more comfortable, because it's all part of this simple, classic, straightforward, easy to bank model. Shorten the distance between the CEO and the consumer. The other thing is, I feel for the banks with regulation. There's massive, massive cost. And one of the reasons why massive cost is because they're in so many different kinds of financial products and services. So you've got a huge bank of regulation. Now, when you specialise, you can then go about simplifying the regulation so that you only involve with regulation that relates to that particular activity. And I believe it would be possible to do two things: to simplify the regulation and to get rid of a lot of regulation, make it easy for the company and making it easy for the regulator.
And that,
so there's shareholder value. There's too big to fail, which goes more appropriate place for guaranteed deposits, easier regulations, easier to manage, more transparent for the for shareholders and the market generally. And I think the analysts might see that. But to date, it's a dirty word. And I fear that in going down this track and trying to get the discussion going on it, I'm going to get heavied. I'm going to get criticised. You shouldn't be using the knowledge and skills you've learnt about banking. You've now turn around and break the banks up. Well, who am I fighting against? Well, I think one entity I would be fighting with would be Treasury. And you've got to look at it from the point of view of Treasury. Treasury, I don't think the public realise how powerful Treasury is, because Treasury works in the corridors of power. They control a number of our critical agencies, ASIC, APRA, ACCC, etc. And they've got ways and means of exerting their control that we don't even see. And from their point of view, I suspect the thing that's more important to anything else is not having a system failure. Now, if I was the treasurer, I would much prefer to have four banks that I know all about, been around for a long time, rather than multiple banks. It's much easier to supervise, much easier to control. So, and also the banks themselves, because they're in so many areas, it makes them extraordinarily powerful. And the people that are running our banks become very powerful individuals. And isn't it human nature not to have your power base carved up? I don't want my business divided into four. It's perfectly natural. So there's an interesting balance here between those that want the status quo and those that might want to review the model. And it will be interesting to see how this plays out and how it's played. But there certainly will be very powerful arguments against doing anything. Very powerful.
So, John, there's one question which I've been worrying about for quite some time, and it's this. There seems to be a lot of revolving doors between the regulators and the banks and back again. You could almost say it's an incestuous relationship. What do you think about that?
Well, it is. But there's a reason for it. We have a very small gene pool in Australia relative to the size of our banks in this economy. And I think when appointments are being made, there's a struggle to find people that are truly independent and bring a new point of view. But I think we need to struggle a lot more, because when you look at what's happening, if you go through the various agencies, a lot of bank executives are becoming non-executive directors of the banks. A lot of regulators are becoming directors. And we have the advantage, we have the example of Stevens, Fraser and Henry. We've got the example in APRA, where it's substantially composed of bankers. We've got the four accounting firms that control 95% of the audits of the top 200, yet their audit revenue is only 16 to 21%. So that concentration combined with the banking concentration, of course, because there is a flow of people to and from the accounting firms. There's the consulting firms. We have just a handful of powerful consulting houses. And again, there's a movement of people between the consulting houses and the banks and vice versa. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, per se. The trouble is, there's too much of it, and it tends to reinforce the status quo and limit the ability to think outside the square and do something different. And I'm not questioning the integrity of any of these people at all, but just the natural tendency that you're just reinforcing what is, where you've been. Because we're all occupation bound. All our careers are limited by the kind of occupation things were being done. And when we go to another role, we take that with us. So our gene pool is not small enough, it's not big enough for the big entities that we have. It doesn't only apply in Bangor, it applies elsewhere. And that's a difficult problem, because look at the individual appointments, they're all probably very worthy. But you've got to look at the aggregate.
Yeah, the risk is you have groupthink simply because they've all come from the same source, they all think the same way. They basically then don't question stuff that perhaps you should be questioning because of that narrower perspective. And then it becomes self-reinforcing, doesn't it? Yeah. John, I appreciate your time today, and I think you've outlined very clearly the the pros and the cons. And I agree with you, there will be forces on both sides putting the arguments forward. But I suspect that we need to be making these arguments as to the benefits and the reasons as to why it's important, because otherwise the powers that be will just rule the roost as normal. So I think this is a really important conversation.
Well, it hasn't been directly dealt with in any of our inquiries.
Yep.
And it's worthwhile pausing for a minute to go through them. The Murray inquiry, which was meant to be a root and branch review, was anything but. It was a report by a banker, the bankers. It didn't talk about structure. It didn't do an analysis of the sector or do any economic study. It enforced the importance of financial stability and indirectly applauded APRA. You go back one step further, you go to the Wallace Committee. Now, the Wallace Committee, one thing they wanted to do was to hive off APRA from the Reserve Bank. Well, Reserve Bank and Treasury hated that. And that was fought all the way through to the Prime Minister to get. And then you've got the Productivity Commission, which talked more about competition than structure and really didn't address this issue about the arguments for and pro separation. And then, of course, we've got Dehaene, who was told not to get into this territory in effect, but did, in the sense that he's completely disrupted the broker channel, but wasn't prepared to disrupt the banks because benefits wouldn't outweigh the costs. Now, that simple statement, benefit outweighing the costs, is a very important proposition. And that's what needed to be analysed. Now, I suspect that the Dehaene Commission, he didn't have the resources to do that, because quite a lot of resources you need to analyse it. And it could quite well be that there's some big things that I'm missing that will absolutely shoot my argument down. Surely we're mature enough to have an open and transparent conversation about it and debate it in a respectful way, Your Honour.
Thank you, John. Well, I appreciate your time today. That's been really interesting. And I'm sure that the audience will be very grateful for your time and for your experience. And we'll certainly keep this conversation going as the Senate inquiry runs, see where it ends up. Thank you for your time.
Good. Thank you.